From Greensburg to Lebanon, Ephrata to State College, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Philadelphia School District is planning to consolidate schools, but continues to trap students in underperforming and often violent buildings. Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation is here to discuss. A recent ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court invalidating certain tariffs has one small business taking legal action in an effort to secure a refund. Kathy Hoekstra of the Pacific Legal Foundation has details. And affordability continues to be a key issue. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary on some steps that can be taken to make life more affordable. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. If you drive on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, this should not be a surprise. Pennsylvania and our neighboring states pay the most highway toll dollars per year. The Center Square reports on a study by the Beck and Beck law firm that finds Pennsylvanians pay about $18.68 for every 1,000 miles traveled. While that is less than drivers in Delaware and New Jersey pay, it puts Penns Woods in the top five highest of the 27 states that have toll roads. The Pennsylvania Turnpike is consistently ranked as the most expensive toll road in the United States. It would cost you $113 to drive the entire way across the Commonwealth. As lawmakers grapple with a nearly $6 billion state budget deficit, the Tribune News Service reports that last year the Commonwealth paid $397 million in overtime to roughly 56,000 employees. A similar expenditure is projected for this year. The News Service pointed out that is a nearly 50% increase since 2019. Corrections, transportation, human services, and the state police account for most of the overtime cost. The city of Philadelphia is going to host the World Cup later this year, and it's vying for another high-profile event. The Inquirer reports that Philadelphia is under consideration to host the 2028 Democratic National Convention. The city is under consideration, along with Boston, Atlanta, Chicago, and Denver. Chicago hosted the 2024 Democratic National Convention, which was last held in the City of Brotherly Love in 2016. In an effort to kill the goose before it lays the golden egg, Democratic legislators on the House Energy Committee have advanced two bills that would layer bureaucratic restrictions on the development of data centers. The proposed red tape includes requiring data centers to report annually on water and energy use, something not required of other businesses. The data centers are a vital component in the growing field of artificial intelligence. The United States and China are locked in a global battle for supremacy in that field. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The Philadelphia City School District is embarking on a program to realign and consolidate school buildings. But Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation says this is akin to rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Guy is a senior fellow at the Commonwealth Foundation. He writes for Broad and Liberty and Real Clear Pennsylvania. Guy, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Guy, your recent article talked about the City of Philadelphia schools. They're building a plan to consolidate, to realign schools. What is the motivation behind that, and is it something that the school district ought to be focusing on at the moment?
Loman, the Philadelphia School District, I remind your listeners that when you talk about the Philadelphia School District relative to the other 499 districts, it's the largest, but that's like saying the Yankees have won more World Series than the Phillies. I mean, they're not in the same stratosphere. The Philadelphia School District is 108,000 children. The second largest is Pittsburgh, which is barely 20,000. So it's an enormous school district. The problem, Loman, for them is that it used to be a city of 2.5 million people. Now it's a city of 1.5 million. And they, unlike the private sector or unlike people in their homes, Philadelphia hasn't really right-sized. So the superintendent set up apparently a blue ribbon commission, and they've unveiled what they're called their master plan for facilities to determine what buildings should be closed, what buildings should be consolidated, and where they may need to build new buildings. And part of the consolidation is where they may even do schools within schools. And some of the issues they cite are that some of the buildings are 100 years old, but that many of them don't have heat. There's asbestos issues. There's lead in the water. They don't have proper heat, or they don't have air conditioning. And it raises a lot of issues, not the least of which is that taxpayers, the folks listening to this, bear in mind that 62 cents of every dollar they spend in Philadelphia comes from state or federal money. So your audience, the folks listening, are the ones paying for the Philadelphia School District. 62 cents of every dollar comes from outside of the city of Philadelphia. So we all do have a vested interest aside from the lives of those 108,000 children. But they were given $2 billion in so-called COVID money to take care of health and welfare. And in Philadelphia, they neither used it to help students catch up for the ones who are falling behind, and they didn't really use it to do the things we're talking about today in 2026, namely health-related, getting the lead, getting new pipes so there's not lead in the water, making sure the heat worked, making sure the ventilation systems worked, make sure that there was proper air conditioning and ventilation. So now we are, you know, 5-6 years post-COVID, and now they're going to close some of those buildings, apparently in an attempt to save money. Again, in a district, I would point out, where they spend on average $24,000 a child. And I wrote the column because of my frustration that it's a school district where test scores are among the lowest in the state. The safety issues are among the most dangerous in the state. And the superintendent calls together the best and brightest to take care of a problem which has been obvious for years, could have been solved with COVID dollars, and now in 2026 they're going to study it. Probably won't get it fully executed till 2027 or 2028. So the kids aren't learning, the kids aren't safe, and taxpayer money's not being used wisely, and the best and the brightest were assembled not to figure out how to help children read or how to make them safe, but instead to shuffle around buildings. It's an enormous waste of time and an enormous misuse of talent on things that don't really affect the lives of children.
Interesting that you mentioned here, Guy, that the city of Philadelphia has had a population decline. The number of students in the Philadelphia public schools have also declined, yet we're spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars more a year on this. Is this also a problem across the Commonwealth where we see declining enrollment, declining student populations, yet the money doesn't ever seem to go down?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, the reality is Pennsylvania, as you and I've discussed, and you've discussed it quite some length on your program, Pennsylvania's had a relatively stagnant population, not just losing our place to states like Florida or Georgia that are growing in population, but in absolute numbers, we sort of stagnate, tick up, tick down a bit. So as a result, our student population has been stagnant or falling. And look, it's an urban problem. It's a Philadelphia problem. It's a Reading problem. But it's also a rural Pennsylvania problem where the economy is not strong. In communities where the economy is not strong, the population is stagnant or falling. And as we've discussed, unlike the private sector, unlike in your family, you know, sometimes families downsize when the kids grow up and move out, and mom and dad, they sell their home with three bedrooms and buy a home with one bedroom or two. The Philadelphia School District is sort of the shining, or not shining, but sort of the darkest example of not keeping pace and not downsizing slowly over time. So now they have too many buildings for too many kids and too many buildings and too much disrepair because they haven't kept up. So it is a statewide problem in those communities that are not growing, right? We have listeners in suburban Philadelphia where that are growing, or in the Poconos, or around York where we see population continue to grow. But in communities that are shrinking, all too often the districts don't keep up by consolidating or getting rid of buildings they don't need. And instead, they pour good money after bad, keeping buildings that are 50, 60, 80, 100 or more years, try to keep them operational. As I said today, in Philadelphia, your listeners and you and me, we're spending money to remove asbestos and get lead out of water and fix heating and air duct systems that are in many cases, older than me, where there's been missed opportunities. So on the one hand, you say, well, gosh, I'm glad they're getting their act together. But the downside is they're still going to have way too many buildings. And as I point out in my column, they're opposing charter schools in the very district, and they pay lobbyists millions of dollars. Bear in mind, again, all of us listening pay 62 cents of every dollar. They spend millions of dollars to block new charter schools, and they spend millions of dollars on lobbyists to block school choice. To which I say, if you really want to consolidate buildings and you really want to have less buildings, then there are probably 20 to 30,000 children whose parents would like them to be somewhere else, in a charter school, a parochial school, or a private school, that if they were given the resources, they could leave. And then Philadelphia could really have a consolidation plan. So this is a statewide problem. It's just that Philadelphia is the most glaring example.
It is utterly amazing that in 2026 here, Guy, you could have school buildings that have asbestos and lead in pipes. Certainly no excuse for that being the case. Also, no excuse here, Guy, for the fact that you have, and you can maybe touch on this briefly, you have underperforming schools to a huge degree in the city of Philadelphia. Students are not being educated, yet they're fighting, as you mentioned, tooth and nail to prevent charter schools or giving students and their parents school choice. Is there any movement at all or any way to sort of force the issue, even from the statewide level, to start giving parents and students those options so their students aren't trapped only in underperforming schools academically, but are in an unhealthy and sometimes even violent environment?
You make an excellent point. You summarize so many good ideas. But as I wrote in my column, I would ask your listeners to sort of suspend belief for a moment and imagine that you're the parent in Philadelphia of a 10-year-old young man, and your child is 10, so in fourth or fifth grade. And I can tell you this, the proficiency rates in Philadelphia on average are 30% for math and 25% for reading. 75% of the schools have been determined by the U.S. Department of Education as being dangerous. So we go back to our hypothetical. You're the parent of a 10-year-old boy. There is a very large chance, very high percentage, that your son goes to a school where almost no one does grade-level reading and math. There's a 75% chance that the U.S. Department of Education categorizes your son's school as violent. Now, to make matters worse, Philadelphia does not allow new charter schools to open, and Philadelphia spends money on lobbyists to lobby against school choice. If you're a middle-class, working-class family, if you're someone living in Philly and you maybe make $50,000 a year, $55,000 a year, you can't afford to move, you can't afford tuition, and your son is locked out of charter schools because there's a waiting list of 20,000. There's a waiting list of 20,000. The waiting list for charter schools in Philadelphia, the waiting list of children to get to a charter school is larger than the Pittsburgh School District. That's how many parents know they want to be somewhere else. So think about a district where as a parent, you're sending your kid off, he's not learning to read, he's not learning to do math, there's a 75% chance the school is violent. And by the way, as tie this all up, there's a good chance he's in a building where either you're not supposed to drink from the water fountain, or there's poor heating, or there's an asbestos issue, or there's certainly no air conditioning for May and June classes. You don't know whether to scream or cry.
Guy Shiraki with the Commonwealth Foundation. You can also read his writings at Broad and Liberty, also Real Clear Pennsylvania. To wrap up here, Guy, give us just a few words about the Commonwealth Foundation, also their website.
Sure, commonwealthfoundation.com. And Commonwealth Foundation is, you know, sometimes we say a think tank, but it's not just really a think tank. It's an ideas tank. It is a group of men and women who've come together that said, in short, how do we make Pennsylvania better? How do we make it more attractive? How do we recruit and retain businesses? How do we make sure children can go to school, to a school that works? And how do we create jobs and have opportunities so that when our children graduate high school, there's an opportunity to be here when they graduate college? So we come up with a series of policies on everything from how to use Pennsylvania energy up to how do we fix schools, tax policy. And I'm glad to be part of it because Pennsylvania has so much potential. And our children deserve an opportunity, and we know the status quo is not working, which is why our population stagnates.
Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation. Guy, thank you for being back with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
With the U.S. Supreme Court ruling unconstitutional some of the tariffs imposed by President Donald Trump, numerous businesses are seeking a refund of tariffs paid. The Pacific Legal Foundation represents one such small business, Princess Awesome. Kathy Hoekstra has details on this edition of American Heroes.
Well, you've no doubt heard by now about the blockbuster Supreme Court decision that, contrary to the president's claim, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, passed by Congress in 1977, does not authorize the president to impose tariffs. Broadly speaking, this 6-3 ruling is a huge win for the separation of powers in the Constitution and the American people. But for small businesses across the country, the people that they serve and the livelihoods they support, this ruling is personal. It is a lifeline. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Radio Journal. Joining me today is Eva St. Clair, along with Rebecca Melski, children's clothing entrepreneurs and American heroes, whose valiant fight to save Princess Awesome from the president's tariffs has advanced to the next chapter after this very powerful Supreme Court ruling. Eva and Rebecca, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us. We're so happy to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you. Well, Princess Awesome and Boy Wonder is, of course, the name of the business that the two of you co-founded back in 2012 to smash stereotypes. What does this mean when it comes to kids' clothing? And have you had smashing success since you launched the business more than a decade ago now?
Yes, our business has been a smashing success. It turns out there are thousands and thousands of people who have children or who are children at heart and love dinosaurs, trucks, trains, dragons of all kinds on their clothing, that they want to just wear the things that they love and that identify their interests to other people. And we have a wonderful customer base, very loyal returning customer base who love what we do. And we are just delighted that every day we wake up and make clothes that reflect the things that they love.
Well, starting a business is daunting in and of itself, but the two of you dove right into what the New York Times called a crash course in the challenges of American manufacturing. What were those earlier challenges and how did you navigate them?
So when we first started and we were manufacturing exclusively in the United States, we had a really hard time finding all of the different pieces of production. So we had to find a place where we could print the types of prints that we wanted to have on the types of fabrics that we wanted, cotton, knits, like comfortable fabrics for kids' clothing. Then we had to find a factory that would cut and sew to, you know, that would be reasonably priced and could do smaller minimums. Then we had to find elastic, we had to find labels, we had to find pattern makers and someone who could grade it. We had to do each one of those individual pieces separately. And then for every new product that we wanted to make, we had to start the process all over again. And it's in the American supply chain for clothing is very challenging to work with.
You tried really hard to keep everything in America, but that was really costly. So then you discovered China, you developed some really good partnerships with some really good manufacturing folks there. And then President Trump's first administration imposed tariffs on China. So you went abroad to some other countries as well. Before we get into the 2025 tariffs, talk about where you went after China.
So we realized after the 2017 tariffs that it just made sense to have a diversified supply chain. And by the time the pandemic hit, that became so stunningly obvious that we were just actually grateful that we had diversified into different countries, because countries shut down throughout the pandemic at different times and throughout the year, throughout the 2 or 3 years of the pandemic. So we had things that were in production in some countries that didn't come in on time, but other places started opening up. So it really helped a lot to diversify. So over the last 10 years, we've manufactured in China, Bangladesh, India, Peru, Colombia, and Pakistan. Oh, and Vietnam too. So it's been an education, learning how global supply chains work.
And then comes 2025, early in the year, the president imposes a bunch of tariffs on all kinds of countries. Explain how much of a blow this round of tariffs had been for you, not just financially, but the uncertainty caused by the tariffs constantly moving parts.
I mean, it's been impossible. we've had so many production meetings where we've said, okay, well, we thought we were going to make these here, but now the tariffs just went up. So we need to move it to this other country. But what if tariffs go up there? And then, I mean, it's just been impossible. We don't know, or we haven't known, how much our products were going to cost when they come to shore. Like, that is not a way to run a business where you don't know how much your products are going to cost. It's insane. And it's impossible to plan. And it's impossible to make the best, most cost-efficient products for our customers. And it has been it's caused a lot of gray hairs.
And you have had to pay some of the tariffs, right?
Oh, yeah. We paid a lot. Yeah.
In 2025, we paid $30,000 in additional tariffs, right? We expect to pay customs fees. We budget that into our plans. But it was $30,000 in additional tariffs. And looking ahead to this year, had this ruling not happened, we were looking at over $100,000 in additional tariffs.
Let's talk about this decision now. The federal lawsuit you and 10 other businesses filed with free representation from PLF. Yours was among many similar cases. The Supreme Court picked a different one, but you did. Their case was fortified by the amicus support that you filed. And since we're recording this just 3 days after the Supreme Court's ruling, everybody wants to know, what did you think when you learned about the decision?
It was incredible news, and it was so vindicating that Chief Justice Robert used our exact arguments in his brief to read the things that we had written, put into the decision. Was amazing. Like, to know that they agreed with us that Congress is supposed to have the power to tax. This is a major questions doctrine issue. And it is not right for the president to assume that he can take Congress's power just because it's written into a tiny little piece of one law that was not meant to be used in that particular way.
Eva St. Clair, Rebecca Malsky, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and congratulations.
Thank you,
Kathy. And thank you especially to PLF for being the best lawyers in the country.
Well, thank you. Well, we do our best. And you can learn more about Princess Awesome Case and all the work we're doing at Pacific Legal Foundation at pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
Economic statistics are looking good, but affordability remains a dominant issue headed into the midterm elections. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania talks about it on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
If you want to see where the country stands, skip cable news and political speeches. Look at the kitchen table. And across Pennsylvania, families are running the numbers, and too often, the math doesn't work. At Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania, our grassroots activists are on the doors every single day. We're in small towns, suburban neighborhoods, and even city blocks, talking to constituents right on their doorsteps. Regardless of party registration or income level, one issue rises above the rest: affordability. Pennsylvanians feel like they're working just as hard as they were a few years ago, but their paychecks don't stretch as far as they used to. Grocery prices are just now beginning to decline, utility bills are up, and mortgage rates have priced young families out of the housing market. This didn't happen by accident. Policy decisions have consequences. Years of excessive federal spending during the Biden era have fueled inflation and eroded purchasing power. When Washington spends trillions beyond its means, it shows up in higher prices at the store and higher interest rates on loans. Inflation operates like a hidden tax, hitting working families and retirees the hardest. Now that we're finally seeing change in Washington, Congress can change course by restoring fiscal discipline, reforming the broken budget process, and rejecting the idea that every challenge requires another massive spending bill. Families in Pennsylvania must live within their budgets. The federal government should be expected to do the same. Energy policy is another area where Congress can make immediate difference. Energy touches nearly every aspect of daily life. It determines what we pay at the pump, what we pay to heat our homes, and what it costs to transport goods across the country. America is rich in natural resources, yet federal permitting delays, duplicative regulations, and ideological constraints have limited supply and driven up costs. Expanding domestic production, streamlining infrastructure approvals, and allowing innovation in traditional and emerging energy sectors would ease price pressures across the economy. Energy abundance lowers costs for families, it strengthens national security, and it supports good-paying jobs, many of which are right here in the Commonwealth. Healthcare remains one of the largest financial burdens on families and small businesses. Instead of empowering patients, federal policy has layered the system with mandates, limited transparency, and fewer choices. Congress can expand access to health savings accounts and remove barriers to direct primary care arrangements. When consumers have information and options, competition works. When competition works, prices come down. Finally, housing is another area where affordability challenges are front and center. For many young adults, home ownership feels increasingly out of reach. Limited supply, regulatory hurdles, and slow development processes have driven up prices. While states and municipalities play a significant role in housing policy, Congress can examine federal rules and incentives that contribute to the problem. Encouraging flexibility, reducing unnecessary federal barriers, and supporting policies that allow markets to respond to demand will help increase supply and stabilize prices over time. The goal should be simple here. Make it easier to build so that families can afford to buy. Underlying all these issues is a broader principle. Economic growth and affordability are not driven by government control, but rather freedom. When small businesses can expand without being bogged down by red tape, they hire more workers. And when workers have opportunities, wages rise. When entrepreneurs can innovate without navigating endless regulatory obstacles, consumers benefit from better products at a lower price. Congress should focus on creating an environment where growth happens from the bottom up rather than the top down. At Americans for Prosperity, we believe affordability is about more than short-term relief, but instead about removing the structural barriers that make everyday life unnecessarily expensive. It's about trusting individuals more than bureaucracies and markets more than mandates. Listening to the people who are feeling the strain most acutely. Our grassroots team hears it every day at the doors. Families don't want handouts. They want to keep more of what they earn. They want leaders who understand that every policy has a cost and that those costs ultimately land on their families. Congress can help make life more affordable, and it will require discipline, courage, and a renewed commitment to the principles that have historically made this country prosperous. Limited government, free enterprise, and individual liberties. If lawmakers focus on fiscal responsibility, families will begin to feel relief not through temporary fixes, but through lasting change. Head to AFPPennsylvania.com to join our movement to make life more affordable for Pennsylvania families. This is Emily Bry, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. The 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now just about a month away. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier grassroots activist event of the year. This year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 9th through 11th at the Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. This year's featured dinner speaker will be Chris Ruddy, the founder and CEO of the Newsmax Cable Television Network. Washington Examiner columnist and Fox News contributor Joe Concha will be the conference luncheon speaker. They will be joined by a wide array of speakers, panel presentations, and an expanded menu of workshops. Complete information and registration for the 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now available at paleadershipconference.org. Join us for the conservative event of the year, the 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. Again, registration available at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal, plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.